And welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining us here in the second hour. We're talking with Roger Stone about his book, Nixon's Secrets. And we have a lot more to discuss and get into. So we're going to pick this right up here. But, you know, many people are surprised that Nixon was in Dallas in November back in 1963. What happened here? How did he end up here? And what role did this have to do with his own presidency later?
Well, it's very interesting that no less than four American presidents would be on the ground in Dallas November 22nd, 1963. Kennedy, of course, Johnson, who would become president, Nixon, who would become president, and ironically, George H.W. Bush. Now, for 30 years, Bush said he couldn't remember where he was. And then in 1987, the American Assassinations Review Board of the federal government released documents that had been classified, including a memo from J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, to one of his underlings, talking about right-wing Cuban activity and certain inquiries that he wanted in the Dallas area. But in the last paragraph, he says, be sure to fully brief George Bush of the CIA on your activities.
Yeah.
At the same time, a second memo is declassified. This is a memo from the head of the FBI in Houston, who reports for the file that seven minutes after John Kennedy was shot, George H.W. Bush, an oil man from Houston, known to the office, called to say that he was in Tyler, Texas, but that he had heard the bad news about the president, and wanted to point out to them that he had heard that a young man in Houston named James Parrott, a conservative member of the Young Republicans, may or may not have made threats against the president.
Yeah.
This is a canard.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, did I mention that I'm in Tyler, Texas right now, 40 miles away from Dallas? Did I mention that? So it's clearly a memo designed to provide an alibi. An alibi for what? We don't know. Anyway, Nixon is in Dallas because he has a legal client, Pepsi-Cola Bottling. The PepsiCo company is his largest legal client. He's their lawyer. But he's there to speak to a bottlers convention. The other speaker is Joan Crawford. He's kind of there as a paid celebrity, although I guarantee you he's billing by the hour as a lawyer. Traveling with one aide from the law firm, one younger lawyer, you know, he is landing commercial. He flies in commercial a day early. He has a press conference at a downtown hotel that gets widely covered, in which he says JFK is in trouble because of the rising stink about Lyndon Johnson. Johnson will be dumped from the ticket, he predicts, because Kennedy now realizes he's a liability. This really sets the stage for what happens on November 22nd. That can be seen on YouTube, that particular broadcast. Then there is some, and this is kind of, there's a lot of intrigue here. Oliver Stone would have you believe in his movie, that Nixon attends a late night bash at the home of Clint Murchison, the millionaire oil man. And that many others are there, including J. Edgar Hoover, H.L. Hunt, a number of other movers and shakers, John Carrington, a lawyer for H.R. Hunt, D.H. Byrd, the man who owns the Texas School Book Depository Building, who is a financial benefactor of Lyndon Johnson, and Johnson himself are supposedly all at this cocktail party the night before Kennedy's assassination. And they supposedly disappear behind closed doors after midnight, a smaller group of men. Well, Nixon could not have been there because the Dallas Morning News reports Nixon arriving at the rooftop supper club at the Baker Hotel at 10 o'clock at night. And the MC says, we have a very special guest in the house tonight, Richard Nixon, like him or hate him, the former vice president of the United States, which is kind of a nasty line. Nixon smiles, and he's identified. That's reported in the contemporaneous newspaper. So he could not have been at a ranch, you know, almost an hour outside of Dallas after midnight or around midnight. I do think, however, that Nixon did attend a cocktail party at that ranch much earlier in the meeting. And I confirm this in my book. It's on his schedule. That's because Clint Murchison, Johnson's benefactor, the man many who many believe financed the Kennedy assassination, is also a heavy donor to Nixon. All of the big oil men who are funders of LBJ, H.L. Hunt, D.H. Byrd, all these guys protecting the oil depletion allowance, they're also heavy donors to Dick Nixon.
Right.
Nixon tells two different stories about how he learns about Kennedy's assassination. The initial story is that Kennedy's Air Force One is landing just as Nixon's commercial flight to New York is leaving, which had to be rather painful for Nixon to see the majesty of that. He says that when he was riding home from the airport in New York in a cab, his cab driver took a wrong turn in Queens. He pulled up to a stoplight, and there was a heavy-set black woman sobbing hysterically on the side of the road. He rolled down the window and said, what's wrong? And she says, the president's been shot.
Mm-hmm.
Reflect for a moment how surreal it must have been for that woman to see a cab roll down and have Richard Nixon stick his face.
Right.
what's bothering you?
Yeah.
I mean, that had to be, maybe the woman, I'm surprised she wasn't hysterical. Then Nixon says that by the time he gets to his apartment on Park Avenue, interestingly enough, an apartment house he shares with Nelson Rockefeller as neighbors.
Hmm.
An odd place to put two men who are arch rivals.
For sure.
By the way, Nixon's law firm, their biggest legal client besides PepsiCo, well, that would be Chase Manhattan Bank, or the Rockefellers, as they're known.
Yeah.
So even Nixon is on the Rockefeller tit. At the point that Rockefeller figures out he'll never defeat Nixon in politics, he basically buys him.
Right, yeah.
That's a little crass, but they have a political rapprochement. They would become mutually supportive. They support Dick, and Nixon promotes Rockefeller. So, terrific new biography out on Nelson Rockefeller by Richard Norton Smith that I highly recommend.
Right.
It's written from a kind of a liberal Republican point of view, but it is stunning, really stunning. Rockefeller is a giant of this period who kind of gets ignored. He's the most powerful man in the country.
Oh, sure, yeah.
His family is deeply entangled with the CIA. He has a secret friendship with Lyndon Johnson and the other party. Yet, try as he can't beat this up-from-dirt, humble farm boy from California. Nixon just eats his lunch twice. Cuts him off at the knees when he tries to wrench the nomination away from Nixon in 1960, and then makes short work of him, you know, after losing two elections, makes short work of Rockefeller in the 68 process. Bluffs him out, then Rockefeller gets in late. It's an epic tale.
Well, the Rockefellers have certainly funded a lot of things that have led to the slow kind of corrosive destruction of America, really, not only the moral fabric, but more directly industrially as well. But
to go back to the Murchison Ranch, because that's really where the tale picks up. I think there is a late night meeting. Nixon is not there, but all those other gentlemen are. H.L. Hunt is too old. He's gone home, and his lawyer, John Carrington, is representing him. D.H. Byrd, Ed Clark, Johnson's law partner, he's the drum major of the assassination. He's Mr. Get It Done. Barr McClellan, in his epic book, Blood, Money, Power, he was a partner in that law firm, tells the story of how Ed Clark and Lyndon Johnson bumped off John Kennedy. It is one of the forerunners to my book, and it's stunning. As I tried to approach this, and Nixon is very much a piece of my Johnson book because what he's doing in Dallas is part of this narrative, I basically make the case using motive, means, and opportunity, fingerprint evidence, eyewitness evidence, and deep Texas politics to just show why Johnson has unique opportunity by his control of the Dallas police and Dallas district attorney are necessary for any plot to succeed. Yes, the Central Intelligence Agency is involved. They're upset about the Bay of Pigs, and they're upset about the, even worse, the Cuban Missile Crisis. They know what the American people are not told for 40 years because it's classified, that in the showdown between Kennedy and Khrushchev, it was Kennedy who blinked. We removed our missiles secretly from Italy and Turkey at the demand of the Russians. They removed nothing.
Yeah.
They claimed that they would remove our missiles from Cuba, but the agreement had no enforceability because they wouldn't allow on-site inspections. And we could never really be sure they ever took their missiles out, which our concession did allow the Soviets to inspect that our missiles were out of the European theater where they didn't want them. This is, outrageous that the American people weren't told that.
Yeah.
Instead, we were told this fiction that bashing, brave, good-looking John Kennedy faced down Khrushchev. First of all, we now know that John Kennedy was high during their discussions. He literally, by the end of his life, he could not function without methamphetamine. It explains his rabid, you know, his just really reckless sex life. His lust for a guy who's got a bad back and can barely walk.
Yeah.
It really explains a lot.
It's a different story for sure. Now, what do you make of something like Operation 40 in all of this? I think you mentioned Frankster just a little bit earlier.
I think that's really where this whole thing starts. I mean, in essence, what happens here is that Nixon is the head of an operations group. Eisenhower has deputized him to run the effort to get rid of Castro. He has green-lighted a plan in which the Central Intelligence Agency will reach out to the mob in order to get the mob to run intelligence on the Cuban island. You see, when the CIA, when Castro takes control, he figures out who are CIA agents and he kills them all, or they are forced to leave. So we have no American intelligence of what's happening on the ground in Castro. We need to know stuff like, which road does he take home? Where does he eat? Which senoritas does he visit? Where can we get an opportunity to shoot this guy? Nixon signs off on an unholy relationship between the Central Intelligence and organized crime. And Robert Mayhew, who later emerges as the major domo for the industrialist Howard Hughes, recently played by Leonardo DiCaprio in the movies, who's a dashing, you know, swashbuckling industrialist with a lot of dough, and he's a heavy political player in these days. Interestingly, Hughes made loans to Nixon's families in the late 1950s, which became a political embarrassment. And anyway, Mayhew, who worked for Hughes, is authorized, former FBI man, authorized to reach out to Johnny Roselli, Johnny Handsome, I mean, who is a crime associate who many believe is one of the shooters in Dealey Plaza. He writes in his own memoir that he was. And there's a lot of evidence that it's true. The assassination attempts on Castro don't work. Nixon's counting on them. He wants to whack Castro before the 1960 election. This is the October surprise Dick Nixon has planned. This is why he figures he's going to beat Kennedy in the stretch, because he's going to be able to take credit for killing Castro, and it doesn't work. The plans are, they all fail. This anger, this whole plan turns into the Bay of Pigs, in the sense that they now divert the exact same people to a new mission, Bay of Pigs, which has two prongs. The assassination of Castro is still on the table, and indeed the Kennedy brothers would keep trying, and the invasion, which are supposed to go down at the same time, but we could never quite get that right. So Nixon, the Cubans, the CIA and Nixon play, the CIA and Kennedy play high-stakes chicken. The CIA blames the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion, which is a fiasco in which our men are cut down on the beach like dogs, and many taken prisoners, and they squeeze us for the prisoners later. They claim that Kennedy never ordered promised air support, and Kennedy argues he never promised air support, that the CIA thought they could bluff him into it at the time, which they did. LeMay and these guys go to Kennedy and say, the only way to save this invasion is to bomb these people back into the Stone Age. And Kennedy would not do so. Kennedy insists that the Bay of Pigs, his entire criteria was, yes, we'll do it, but it must look covert. It must look like it comes from Cuban nationals. It can't look like it came from us. Well, then the Air Force would certainly put our fingerprints on it.
It's interesting how they didn't manage to, considering the assets that they have at their disposal and a lot of experience there, both, you know, with these assassinators and everything else, that they didn't manage to get closer to what they had tried to achieve there. Was it sabotage?
Yeah, no, they seem very inept in their abilities to kill Castro. I myself have stood within 40 feet of Castro in New York City. I could have put him away. I was just totally inadvertent. He was coming out of the Plaza Hotel when I was going in the middle of the day on an afternoon, and I came within a good 10 feet of him. Then I realized who he was. And then it occurred to me, had I been a crazed assassin or a government agent, I could easily have popped this guy. How hard could it be? So it is kind of perplexing.
I don't want to get too conspiratorial here, but is there something to say about the fact that the Cold War and this kind of dichotomy of the U.S. versus the Soviet in Cuba versus communism has been very beneficially something that they almost wanted to keep alive to a certain extent? Did they fail for those reasons?
Or to what extent are they infiltrated? I mean, there are evidence of some so-called moles presenting themselves to us as defectors who are, in fact, feeding us disinformation, a giant embarrassment to the agency if it becomes public.
Right, yeah.
To what extent are our policies being affected by moles in the same period? So it's very hard to say, but I think that the whole point here is that the Kennedy Bay of Pigs lays the groundwork. The Cuban Missile Crisis makes it worse. Add to that the Secret Service, which at that point has let the Joint Chiefs and the CIA know that the president has this weird doctor who comes to inject him 3 times a day. And the weird doctor has been given quarters in the White House. You can see how they are rationalizing why they have to kill Kennedy. God, for my good God, man, he's a drug addict. He could give away the store. The Soviets could blow us out of the sky and he'd be, and indeed, the president, with all due respect, he's betting 19-year-old interns.
Yeah.
This woman, Mimi Beardsley's book, only a year ago, stunning. I mean, Kennedy basically, nailing her on the upstairs bedroom while Jackie's out of town. 19 years old.
Yeah, these are security risks, and this has been known for years in this capacity that you can blackmail politicians and they run sting operations.
Well, let's be very clear about how Johnson gets on the ticket. The 1960 ticket, Johnson and Kennedy have a very bitter contest. Johnson arranges for the break-in into the offices of Kennedy's doctors in New York City, which, by the way, the historian David Brinkley blames on Richard Nixon, when it's not Nixon at all, it's Johnson. You know this because just before the convention, John Connolly, Johnson's closest colleague, John Connolly, attacks JFK for having Addison's disease. That could only have come from the medical records that were rifled by Lyndon Johnson. This is why Bobby hates Kennedy so much. Robert Kennedy just goes insane when they play the health card. But by the way, Kennedy's two doctors release a letter that's a total fraud. They say he's in perfect health and he does not have Addison's, which is false. He's in terrible shape physically. So that's concealed from the American people. And it's part of the Kennedy lore that never kind of gets out there. It's not surprising that the so-called military industrial complex has a way to rationalize the murder of a president.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the mob has they have a completely different motive. They made a deal with Ambassador Joseph P. Kennedy. They gave him $1 million with the understanding that when Jack Kennedy became president, the Justice Department efforts to deport Santo Traficante, who runs the mob in Florida and Louisiana, and Carlos Marcello, who's in Texas and Louisiana, not be deported. Traficante runs Florida. That these gentlemen not be deported. And of course, after Joseph Kennedy is incapacitated with stroke, Bobby becomes Attorney General, of course, and he goes after both those mobsters. They also twisting arms for Jack Kennedy, so they feel they elected him in the West Virginia primary. I mean, they use a lot of muscle on Election Day in West Virginia and Illinois to steal votes and to intimidate voters.
Right.
Part of the deal. So their motive for wanting to kill Kennedy is clear. Big Texas Oil, they're furious because Kennedy wants to repeal the oil depletion allowance, so they're at the table. That's hundreds of millions of dollars. I use a fingerprint to tie a hitman, Malcolm Wallace, who is an associate of Johnson's of longstanding. Wallace is a convicted murderer. I believe he's the shooter from the Texas School Book Depository building. I use his fingerprint. 6 eyewitnesses tell the FBI or the Dallas police that they see a man in the window of the sixth floor who is heavyset, wearing glasses, very key, and balding. That's not Lee Harvey Oswald. That's a perfect description of Malcolm Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
One man sees a man who meets the same description of Wallace. They all describe him, white shirt, tan pants. And a couple of them say tortoiseshell glasses, horn rim glasses. That's how prominent his glasses are. It's I think, Malcolm Wallace. I think there's multiple shooters. I think there's a shooter in the sewer grate, Johnny Roselli. I think there was a mob shooter on the grassy on the fence line. I mean, the autopsy by the Warren Commission at this point is so discredited. I mean, he clearly has wounds in the front and the back of his head. The government goes to great lengths to try to ignore the blowout wounds in the back of his head, but too many doctors at the first hospital, doctors and nurses, saw it and cataloged it. So, anyway, I just think because of his control of the local police, Johnson is the key element here. The CIA can't control the Dallas police, the Dallas prosecutor, either can the mob.
Yeah.
And Johnson is just a look at his face. Right after he's sworn in, he winks at one of his Confederates.
On the plane, yeah, I remember seeing that photo. Oh, yeah.
First of all, there was no reason whatsoever for the swearing in. By law, the vice president automatically becomes president upon the death of the president. Johnson's already president. Throughout his career, he says, Bobby Kennedy told me to take the oath immediately. That's a lie. Bobby Kennedy never said that. What Johnson did was to twist the knife. He called Bobby instead of saying, oh, I'm so terrified, but he starts the conversation by saying, get me the text of the oath. I'm going to be taking it here shortly. Bobby already knows that Johnson is president. He has the power when he makes that call. That's twisting the knife. And then through his whole life, he said, Bobby Kennedy urged me to take the oath immediately. Kennedy never said anything of the kind.
Mm-hmm.
He says so in his memoirs.
Right.
Lady Bird Johnson breaks out into a broad grin. No, I mean, it is, he has you. His motive is absolutely clear. He knows that Bobby Kennedy is not only going to dump him from the ticket, but Bobby wants to send him for prison. Lyndon Johnson knows there's no less than 9 full-time investigative reporters on the ground from Time Life digging into his finance for a December 1st story fed to them by Robert Kennedy's Justice Department of graft and corruption by Lyndon Johnson. Johnson is epically corrupt. He's taking a payoff for anything and everything that moves. Defense contracts, for protecting the oil depletion allowance, and he operates in cash. His bagman is one John B. Connolly, later emerges as a right-hand man to Richard Nixon. Of course, famously wounded with President John F. Kennedy. Those who say, well, why would Johnson put his right-hand man open convertible with Kennedy if he knew Kennedy was going to be shot and that Connolly might be. And the point was, Johnson never told Connolly. Connolly didn't know when he went. Johnson was willing to sacrifice him if that's what it took to get them to drive through Dealey Plaza. Remember, we know that it is Connolly who insists on this route. Johnson and Connolly have no interest in the logistics of John Kennedy's trip to San Antonio or Fort Worth. They're strongholds. They don't care. You can come any way you want, go any way you want, but they micromanage the schedule on the ground in Dallas. That is, to me, having worked on eight presidential trips in the states I was handling, that's not the norm, I can tell you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you about a little bit of the bigger picture here as well and how it relates to some of the things that goes on today. I mean, the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis, assassination of JFK, the Watergate scandal, and later the Iran-Contra affair. These are really like a string of events that shows the massive corruption. It sets something off here that alludes to the American people, how politics really is run. Has this ended? Does America have the time that it went into?
Let's do it in a comparison. One of the articles of impeachment against Nixon was that he bombed Cambodia without congressional approval. We're bombing in Iraq today without congressional approval.
Yep.
One of the charges against Nixon in the articles of impeachment was that he used the IRS for political purposes against his enemies. This administration, by the way, he never did do that successfully. He only talked about it. This administration has successfully done that. And we're talking about thousands of more cases, a much more egregious violation of the law. Nixon is accused of wiretapping his political agents wiretapped the opposition headquarters, a violation of civil liberties. This president is wiretapping the entire country. In fact, the world. Hendrick, he's reading your email.
Yeah, I know.
Listening to our cell phone call.
I know.
Again, the more egregious violation of the law and the Constitution today. It is entirely ironic that when it comes to violating the Constitution, you know, Barack Obama makes Richard Nixon look like a Boy Scout.
That's just my point. I mean, I said maybe for its time, the Watergate scandal was a big deal, but in some ways it seems innocent compared to what's happening today. The Fast and Furious,
I mean, compared to Barack Obama, Richard Nixon is Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm.
Yeah, that's right. The Fast and Furious, the IRS, you know, scandal, Obamacare, Benghazi.
Gun running. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. So what is it going to take for this to begin to turn around? Because, I mean, if the system has been run
here is the impediment, and that is there's certainly a public appetite for a new party in a new direction. The voters will tell you in poll after poll that they're unhappy with the two choices they have. But at the same time, the people who write the laws about how our campaigns are run and what is required to get on the ballot, particularly, are Republicans and Democrats working together.
Yeah.
And they want to make insurgency and independence as difficult as possible. So the fact that the Libertarian Party for candidate for governor, former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson, got on the ballot in 48 states is a Herculean political achievement. That he got no credit for with the mainstream media, and it certainly didn't get him what it should have gotten, which is into the debate. There's your biggest problem. You see, the Presidential Commission on Debates is not appointed by the president. It's not a commission, and it's certainly not about debate. They didn't want a third-party candidate who's on the ballot in 48 states to be at that debate. So they make up some phony poll. You have to poll 25%. I mean, they just make it unattainable. My attitude is, if you're on the ballot in enough states to theoretically get 270 electoral votes, theoretically, you should be allowed in the debate.
Yeah.
That's hard to do. You can't say, we have too many nuts. No, you won't. Nobody who's crazy can do that. That's a Herculean organizational task. It cost about $6 million.
Yeah.
But Johnson achieved it. I'm proud to say that I helped him achieve it. And on Election Day, 7 out of 10 people didn't know who he was because he wasn't permitted to go to the debates and say, I will legalize and tax marijuana. I will bring all of our troops home now. I will end the war in Afghanistan. I'm an open borders guy. I mean, those are all compelling things that somebody needed to say it in the debates. As Romney and Obama try as hard as possible to sound different when, in fact, when it comes to spying, spending, taxing, making war, they're exactly the debt. They're all exactly the same. They're just the same. The Republican Party of my youth, the one that I have such affection for, the party of Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, that party's dead. It's a Wall Street party now. It was a mainstream party. It was a mainstream party then.
Yeah. What happened with the neocons? How did they take over, and what is their agenda?
Well, I mean, I think the neocons, there are a lot of hardliners in the Republican Party, foreign policy hardliners. This is born of anti-communists. These are the same people who were hardline anti-communists, and now they're hardline anti-Muslims. It's very hard. Most of my libertarianism, I'm not an isolationist. I'm a non-interventionist. That's not to say that there aren't some really bad people around the world who don't mean us well, but There's too much manipulation. I'm not sure there is an ISIS, or I'm not sure we didn't create ISIS. And now we're paying ISIS to fight ISIS.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Last week we were feeding the Kurds, now we want to bomb the Kurds. We can't seem to decide which side we're on because we're on all sides. I mean, this is the Obama-Clinton foreign policy. And it's not much different from the Bush foreign policy.
No.
That's my entire problem.
Well, that's just it, because the power behind the scenes remains the same. We have AIPAC, which is a tremendously powerful foreign policy organization in America. How much Israel first mentality is running American foreign policy, do you think?
The point is that there you have all these interests. The system runs on money. So it doesn't matter where, I could make the case that Latinos have an inordinate amount of influence right now in our politics. because they're emerging as a very powerful voter group, and therefore they have clout. If you notice lately, Obama and the Democrats are really starting to suffer in the Latin community, which is unheard of. But they're getting sick of nothing being done on immigration. Nothing. Yeah. This deadlock is killing them, and therefore they're ready to leave the Democratic Party for somebody with a solution. That's a very interesting development. It's a problem for the Democrats. They can't afford to lose the fastest growing segment of the population, Hispanics.
How do you think that this is going to play out here? Maybe we have, give me a little bit what you think about the 2016 election, what's going to happen. But primarily my question in the extension is, for a libertarian candidate to actually get on the ballot, what needs to happen in America for this to take place?
Well, first of all, I think you should understand the tumultuous times we're about to have. Ted Cruz is going to make a move in the United States Senate to impeach Barack Obama, whether the Senate leadership likes it or not. And, of course, if you think it through, if you have the grounds to impeach Obama, certainly his on the immigration issue alone, the directive of immigration officials to break the law and let 70,000 children cross the border, that's an impeachable offense without any question.
Yeah.
And if you did that, of course, you then President Joe Biden would kneecap Hillary, kneecap her good, ending that dynasty's potential comeback. Jeb Bush is in the weeds. He wants to restore the family dynasty, as his father has been saying it. George H.W. Bush, ever lustful for power, is pushing hard for Jeb to run. Jeb is wrong on Common Core and immigration for some elements in the Republican Party, powerful elements. He also has his mother's arrogance. Unless your family came from the Mayflower, we're on earth to serve them. These are very officious people, the Bushes. And so that's in the weed. The Libertarian Party, Gary Johnson, who ran for the nomination previously, indicated in the last 24 hours that he was prepared to do so again. For some reason, he criticized Rand Paul. He didn't think Rand Paul was libertarian enough. I don't think there's a constituency for that. If you're a general election candidate, you have to assume that Rand Paul will not get the Republican nomination, and therefore his votes would become available to a potential Libertarian Party candidate. So I don't know why you would want to challenge Rand Paul. That makes no sense to me politically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It also is a major problem. As long as there's any Libertarian contender in the Republican nomination, the Libertarian Party candidate is going to have a hard time getting resources and people, as people, many Libertarians did move from Ron Paul to Gary Johnson in the general election, but they weren't prepared to do so until that nomination fight was over.
Right.
Even when the handwriting was on the wall, that they wouldn't even let Rand Paul's name be announced when votes were cast in the roll call. So it would be Illinois, 27 for Mitt Romney and 7 for Ron Paul. Illinois, 27 for Romney.
Mm-hmm.
And then it continues. I mean, it's just outrageous.
Right.
The way Congressman Paul was treated at his national convention. I mean, he won what he won. He should have had a fair roll call.
Well, exactly. I mean, definitely.
It shows you what the Romneys are really like. These are vicious, vindictive people.
Yeah.
Sanctimonious.
Yeah.
Very obtuse about how the real world works. Believe me, Mitt Romney is George Romney's son.
Will there ever be, I've heard other people talk about this and speculate about this, but, due to the way the American politics have developed and everything else and the background specifically of the GOP and everything else, that they suspect that there actually never will be a Republican president in office ever again, that the Democrats
unfortunately, you can't say that. There are a lot of ticking time bombs for the Republicans. The biggest one is the changes in the population. For the Republicans to survive as a party, they must attract some young people, some Hispanics, some gays, some Asians, some African Americans. It's the only way they can survive. And they don't seem to be putting forward any strategy or issue ideas or policies that would attract any of those people. And if they are, they're not doing a very good job of communicating them, particularly Hispanics. If they can get their piece of the Hispanic vote, and they're almost, I mean, virtually every white American is now voting Republicans. White middle class portion of the overall Democratic vote is a minority now and shrinking.
Yep.
So if you go look at the Obama-McCain contest, McCain has commanding leads among white voters, as does Bush. You combine that with Latino voters, now you've got a coalition in which you might get something done. But there's just no evidence that anybody in the party is thinking about that, with the possible exception of Jeb Bush.
Well, they have but that's a later candidate. But George P. Bush, yes, he looks Hispanic, right? So they're trying to push him, maybe.
Yeah, no. I look, these are dynasties. The Clintons and the Bush, and the idea of we need another Bush like we need another Clinton, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
I wish dynasty should take over is not my idea of a fresh start for America.
Of course not. Of course.
Hillary Clinton's hands are filthy in this Benghazi thing. There's just no question about it. She willfully lies about why our compound was attacked. She just lies about it. It was not caused by some anti-Islamic video that inadvertently got showed in some foreign country online. That's all nonsense. That didn't happen. That is a falsehood promulgated for political reasons by the White House and the State Department, because they didn't want to admit that American interests had been hit by al-Qaeda and Americans had died just weeks before the election, thus handing Romney an issue. They had to suppress that. They had to hide it. It's a canard. And after the intelligence agencies tell the Vice President, the Secretary of State, to her face, that's not true, she repeats the lie at a memorial service for one of the killed servicemen. She repeats it in the face of her parents, of his parents.
Yeah.
That's what we're dealing with.
Yeah. Now, we've talked with other guests as well that are talking more and more about how the polarization of America might actually lead to secession of different kinds, that America will eventually break up due not only to the changing demographics, but even internally, politically, that people are so divided right now. What do you view? What's your view on that?
It is interesting that secessionist candidates are starting to get some traction, and you see more and more proposals, for example, that South Florida should just secede from the rest of Florida, leave the central and the northern part of the state joined together. We had a constitutional amendment here in Florida yesterday to legalize medicinal marijuana. It required 60% for passage under the Constitution, and it got 58, I believe. It's passed as South Florida, you know, with 70 plus, just to give you an example of what secession could mean. Our giant Latino population is the Cubans, are mostly in South Florida, and they are Republicans. The Latinos in the central part of Florida tend to be Puerto Rican, so they're more likely to be Democrat. So the whole secessionist thing is not outside the realm. I think it's going to have a vogue. The only way you'll be able to press it is to run for office as a secessionist candidate, which is kind of interesting. In the meantime, I think we're stuck with the dynamics of the two-party system. It is pretty clear to me that nobody of consequence... Well, I shouldn't say that. I dined the other night with a woman who is a high-level operative for 6 years under Obama, with direct access to the president and his wife and senior staff, who tells me that the idea that the Obamas despise the Clintons is absolutely true, and that the Obamas have been quietly urging Senator Elizabeth Warren, the fiery progressive anti-bank, anti-free enterprise progressive.
Yeah, know her.
Little editorial comment there.
No worries about that. You can speak much louder than that if you want to about her. So
that she challenged Hillary, and that could be very problematic. Hillary is old and stale, and she's enthralled with the Wall Street money. The far left of her party, the left that is battling Governor Andrew Cuomo, for example, in New York, is really not enamored with the idea of another Clinton presidency. Remains to see whether any viable challenge to Hillary surfaces, but if it's not Warren, I don't know who. The senator from Bernard Sanders is a crazy old socialist, and even I wouldn't vote for him. So that's not going anywhere. You need somebody with a rationale. The Republican contest, wide open. Rand Paul, a major factor, Mitt Romney in the weeds, trying to figure out what's going to happen, Jeb Bush, I think, moving towards a candidacy, Chris Christie, a man seen demolishing 8 trays of lasagna this morning as he left Florida. I think he's running. Rick Perry, if he can get free of this indictment on a an appropriate time frame. Is running. He's got a political indictment against him back in Texas, which I think is really transparent. But he does need to get free of it legally before he can run. But he has got very low expectations because of his poor performance last time. Therefore, he has an opportunity if he can, say, live off the land financially and just get to the first debate and shine. He could be a contender. Ben Carson is a dark horse, no pun intended, African American physician. Very well spoken, very well written. I think he's an interesting kind of wild card. Not a political insider. I think in this atmosphere, that's a real possibility. That has potential appeal. Donald Trump, you know, once again, flirting on the edges, capable of spending hundreds of millions of dollars, and has a great way with words in terms of a populist appeal. He gets criticized because, of course, he contends that the president wasn't born in the United States, but, you know, many Americans believe that, and therefore he has a constituency here in the country, in the party. It's not a majority, but it's not insignificant.
Well, you know, as Republicans are trying to appeal more and more to the same people that the Democrats are going for, the parties ends up looking more and more the same. Obviously, this has been true for many years now, but it's, you know, those that used to be loyal to, you know, more conservative parties and whatnot have ends up having nowhere to go. I mean, even from my perspective, being from Sweden, I see how America is moving away more and more from free markets. It's moving more towards a kind of a democratic socialist structure and whatnot. What's going to happen there with America? I mean, it's been built on free markets, you know?
Well, first of all, the parties are adept at sounding different. They really go out of their way to sound different. And it takes the voters some time. I mean, because of the old roles of the party, I think a lot of Republicans believe that when they vote Republican, they're voting for conservative government. They don't realize that their party slowly has drifted. The two parties have drifted together in the center, and they're identical. They spend too much. They borrow too much. They tax too much. They spy too much. They wage stupid wars that have no point, where our interests are not clear. They don't have a coherent foreign policy. We're on all sides of all things. And now when we declare war, we have to do it on the credit card. When we bomb Libya, which never made any sense to me.
No.
Giving the upper hand to the Muslim Brotherhood, who hates our guts and will now seek to kill us.
Yeah.
Gaddafi, this was not our affair. Gaddafi was feeding us foreign intelligence. I believe we were actually educating a couple of his kids in our country. He had flipped. He was nuts. He had done some bad things in the past, but he had flipped. He was a U.S. asset by the time we took him out. This makes no sense.
Yeah.
And he was telling us a lot of things about Al-Qaeda and their operations that we didn't know.
Well, that's just it. He was too much of a problem. As I can't see it any other way. How the foreign policy is run now is that they want to try to create as much chaos and conflict as possible by giving weapons to...
Well, one has to... I mean, you know, it would be unfair to say that Hillary Clinton has no accomplishments at state. They have systematically deposed our friends, regardless of their political complexion, or those who are at least on good terms with us in every country throughout the Middle East, and replaced them with people who hate our guts.
That's right. Exactly.
I mean, it just doesn't make sense as a foreign policy. It's a dangerous world. I'm not arguing that we should send ground troops to the Middle East, but I do think we should be cognizant that these people don't wish us well.
Yeah, I mean, I can't see it any other way. This is it's intentional to further the crisis that we see, and to legitimize more a direct military invention from America's point of view.
That's the real point, and that is you don't know whether these things are being magnified and blown out of proportion by those who have an interest in perpetual war. I don't think one can be a blind isolationist and say, you know, we'll fight our enemies on the shores of California. That doesn't make any sense to me. In any event, I do think that our politics are going to be very difficult under these rules. Look, I am one who's in a minority in some ways, but I think Citizens United has been a good thing. Because I can just tell you, there would be no chance for the people who support liberty to participate in our politics without the ability to take large sums of money. We can't raise enough $25 contributions to fund a Gary Johnson. You just can't.
Right.
And therefore, the invention of soft money lets those very handful of wealthy libertarians who want to further our agenda to play the game the way the laws are written.
Yeah, yeah. What's the prospect that someone like Gary Johnson will end up on the ballot in 2016?
Well, the libertarians will nominate somebody. The question is, can they nominate somebody with any credibility, any name identification, and any fundraising capability? Nominating some, you know, academic or some party activist that no one has ever heard of who can't raise 5 cents just doesn't make sense. Remember that the Libertarian Party has an anarchist faction.
Right.
To me, anarchists don't belong in organized parties. So they're not interested in rules or political viability or elections or votes. They're just interested in havoc. And this is why being a libertarian can be just as trying as being a Republican at times.
Well, again, this is it's because there's no diversity.
In a way, look, Ron Paul was a Republican. He left to become a Libertarian and went back to the Republican Party. Theodore Roosevelt was a Republican president. He left the GOP to an independent party and went back to the Republican Party. If that's where the fight is, I might go back to the Republican Party, but I recognize the inordinate power of the Wall Street wing now.
Yeah.
And the big business wing of the party, and they do have, they do hold the whip hand. I admire, you know, the Pauls for being willing to fight.
Yeah, indeed. Exactly. Well, the bottom line here is that there's no diversity in the political situation in America, and that's why you see a lot of people, you know, they're going for whatever alternative is the least, you know, least evil in their view, right? And that's why you get it gets shattered. I mean, at least in Europe, we have, you know, 7, 8, 9 parties in most countries, and
Right here in the state of Florida, we had an election yesterday where former Governor Charlie Crist was challenging Governor Rick Scott. Rick Scott won that contest, already. You are, everybody wants to talk about the next election, the presidential election. It becomes a never-ending process is part of the problem. Politics are now so totally invasive in our life. We see it round the clock.
Yeah, yeah.
The campaign is a perpetual campaign. The presidential campaign has begun. We're in it right now.
Definitely. Yeah, exactly.
Even before last night.
And it'll be the same circus all over again.
Road here. They need to find somebody viable. Jesse Ventura has indicated that he would take their nomination if they offered it to him. At least he could get the television cameras to show up.
Yeah, well, it'll be the same circus all over again, won't it? No matter.
Well,
there's a
handful of activists who want to draft Judge Andrew Napolitano, the legal analyst for Fox News, a former judge. He would be a credible candidate who could get votes. But I don't think, you know, I don't think you can be drafted. I think you have to, if you want this nomination, you have to go get it. I have a high regard for Gary Johnson. I'm not sure, though, that trying to run to Rand's left is the best strategy.
All right, Roger, we're going to wrap up here in a little bit, but last question for you here. The Nixon tattoo on your back, how did that end up?
Yes. Well, I am interested in all things Nixon. I just find him obsessively interested. I'm both a critic and a devotee. I'm pretty rough on him in his book. I point out that his longtime dalliance with a Chinese mistress is in my book, as well as the fact that he couldn't read music, but he could play the clarinet, the saxophone, the accordion, the violin, and the piano. And he was quite proficient in all of them. At the same time, I admire a quality that's important here, and that is the tattoo is not a political statement. It's a daily reminder that in life, when things don't go your way, when you face setbacks or defeats, when you have disappointments, when you're discouraged, you have an obligation to get yourself up off the ground and get back in the fight. That's the story of Nixon. It's a story of persistence and tenacity and resilience, and indestructibility, and drive that I find compelling. That's why I have this tattoo. It's about the size of a grapefruit, floats between my shoulders, just like a floating head. I was really drunk when I had this done.
Is that true?
Yeah, I was in California. It seemed like a good idea, but it hurts. It's painful. It hurt like hell. So I had to have a few cocktails to assuage the pain.
All right. Well, there you go. Well, I guess
there's actually a picture of it in the back flap of my book, Nixon's Secrets.
All right,
which
very
you,
good.
Of course, as I mentioned, you can get at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and NixonSecrets.com. Also, my own website, StoneZone.com, where I just give political commentary and fashion tips for men.
Well, there you go. That's excellent. NixonSecrets.com and also StoneZone.com. We'll have these links up and, of course, direct links to the books on Amazon as well. Well, it's been great having you here, Roger Stone. Thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. Keep up the good work and hope we can talk with you again in the future.
Hendrik, this was delightful, and I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's something different for you right there on Nixon. It's always good to hear something different for once. Well, we're going to be back in just a few days. We have more coming with Brian Hooker on the CDC whistleblower and the autism vaccine link. A lot of information there coming up. We also have Arthur Topham, Daniel Hammarberg, Jason Erb, Neil Kramer, Carlos Morales, and also Lawrence Eastman. For now, we say thank you for being a member, and my thanks to the team for all their hard work as well. Take good care of yourself, be well, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.